This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا مِنْهُ إِنَّهُ لَيَئُوسٌ كَفُورٌ وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَاهُ نَعْمَاءَ بَعْدَ لَيَقُولَنَّ ذَهَبَ السَّيِّئَاتُ عَنِّي إِنَّهُ لَفَرِحٌ فَخُورٌ إِلَّا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good. They shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran once again criticizes the UN silence on Israel's continued aggression against Syria, saying targeting Syrian civilians and infrastructure violates international law. The US says Russia has informed it of plans to carry out nuclear exercises amid rising tensions over the Ukraine war. And a new poll shows only 39% of Americans are satisfied with President Joe Biden's performance just 2 weeks before US midterm elections. Many thanks for joining us. Iran is once again calling on the United Nations to break its silence on the Israeli regime's continued aggression against Syria. According to Iran's ambassador to the UN, Israel is targeting Syrian civilians and infrastructure in clear violation of international law and human rights. Amir Said Iravani says the UN silence has further emboldened the regime. Israel frequently strikes targets inside Syrian territory. The Damascus government has repeatedly urged the UN to condemn such acts of aggression. On Monday, the regime's warplanes fired several missiles at targets near the capital Damascus, leaving a soldier wounded. Anger is simmering in the occupied West Bank after Israeli forces conducted deadly raids in Nablus and Ramallah, killing at least 6 Palestinians. The attacks injured around 24 others. Mona Kandil has filed this report from Ramallah.
Thousands of mourners took to the streets of Nablus in the occupied West Bank to bid farewell to Palestinians killed by Israeli forces. Early Tuesday, clashes broke out between Palestinian fighters and Israeli forces after regime forces conducted a raid in Nablus. Several Palestinians were killed in the raid. Among the victims was Wadi Hawah, a fighter for the newly formed resistance group Lion's Den. 21 other Palestinians were also wounded in the attack, some of them in critical condition. The Israeli army said it had carried out a vast operation with police and intelligence officers targeting a site used by the main operatives of the Lion's Den, describing it as a headquarters and a workshop for making weapons. Later on Tuesday, regime forces conducted another attack near Ramallah and killed one more Palestinian man. 19-year-old Qusay At-Tamimi was killed during a confrontation in the village of Nabi Saleh. Palestinian officials have condemned the raids as vicious and criminal, but they said such attacks will not break the will of the Palestinian people, who are adherent to resistance as their legitimate right.
Their attacks on Palestinians in Nablus and in Ramallah and in other places will not break the Palestinian will. It will not stop the Palestinian resistance. The Palestinians have understood very clearly that Israel understands only the language of force, and that's why they are ready to defend themselves and defend their rights.
All the Palestinians are in the same tunnel, facing the same atrocities, while the same war crimes are being committed all over the Palestinian territories. The Palestinians are unified through different forms of resistance.
Since the beginning of this year, over 130 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds.
The Israeli regime threatens to continue killing Palestinian resistance fighters under the pretext of battling terrorism. Palestinians, however, say they will remain steadfast in their resolve, stressing that the Israeli atrocities will not stop their resistance. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
The United States says Russia has notified Washington of planned nuclear drills amid allegations that Moscow may use nuclear weapons in the war in Ukraine. State Department spokesman Ned Price said it is part of Russia's routine military drills. He said such notifications reduce the likelihood of misperception. Price said Washington expects Moscow to carry out test launches of nuclear missiles during the drills. But he said the U.S. had no indication Russia is preparing to use nuclear weapons against Ukraine. Some Western countries have accused Moscow of planning to use the so-called dirty bombs. The term is applied to conventional explosive laced with radioactive, biological or chemical materials. Russia has warned that Ukraine could stage a provocation through the use of those bombs. Ukraine says it is strengthening its forces in the southern Kherson region in preparation for an imminent counter-offensive by the Ukrainian military. According to an advisor to President Volodymyr Zelensky, the heaviest of battles is going to take place in Kherson, as Moscow's military is digging in to face advancing Ukrainian forces. The official says there are no signs that Russian forces are abandoning the area. Instead, they are replenishing and strengthening their grouping there. Moscow has been evacuating local residents in anticipation of a Ukrainian counterattack to recapture the city. Kherson is one of the four regions Russia officially annexed last month. Moscow says people in those provinces showed overwhelming support to join Russia in referendums. Kherson is thought to be the most strategically important region among the four. It's been a month since four Ukrainian regions held referendums on joining Russia, while NATO countries called those votes a sham. And as Ukraine continues its offensive to regain territory, Johnny Miller finds out how people in the Russian-held parts of Donbass feel about joining Russia.
The Russian flag now flies over Donetsk, as Russia claims this region is now part of the Russian Federation. The streets in the center are quiet as Ukraine continues to bomb the city. The front line is only 6 kilometers away. In order to find out how people here feel about their new identity, I headed down the road to the adjoining city of Makiivka. There are more people on the streets as it's safer here.
We are very happy. We've been waiting for it for a long time. We're very glad. All acquaintances, neighbors, all people surrounding me are grateful to Russia.
It's a complicated question. After everything that's been going on, it can be no other way now. There's no other way but to be with Russia. We were close people always. We couldn't be divided. We lived quite okay in Ukraine, but it's no longer Ukraine. Their authorities are not Ukrainian anymore.
This is a common sentiment in Donbass, that they were happy being part of Ukraine, but when the nationalists came to power in 2014 and began discriminating against Russian culture and bombing civilians here, they turned toward Russia.
We have been waiting for it. Donbass was eager to become part of Russia. We have the same values, culture, and now that we are part of Russia, we can be ourselves.
I'll tell the truth. While they've been shelling us and we were living in fear, in Kiev, they were enjoying themselves. Nobody in Kiev paid any attention. There are people there who support and understand us, but they cannot speak about it. They can be killed or imprisoned by the SBU for this. We're not against Ukrainian civilians. We are Ukrainian people too. I have relatives there. We have pity for people in Kiev, but nobody's killing them there on purpose.
Thousands have been killed by Ukrainian shelling over the last 8 years here. Hardly a day goes by without more civilians dying. Most of the anger I hear, though, is directed at the Ukrainian government, not its people.
I sympathize with them very much. I am always against people being killed, but it's war. Nothing can be done about it. They're killing us and we have to defend ourselves. Sometimes we had to hide in basements because of shelling. I work at school. Our school was under shelling. The windows were smashed. It's very scary.
Now, doing vox pops in cities on issues around the world, you usually get a variety of opinions. Not so here. Everybody I've spoken to says they want to join Russia. The only difference of opinion seems to be just how much sympathy they have for people in Kiev now living under shelling themselves. The people here have been doing so for the last 8 years. While the southern regions of Zaporozhye and Kherson are more mixed, for peace to come, it's clear the world needs to accept that the vast majority of people in Donbass no longer want to be part of Ukraine. Jenny Miller, Donbass.
As the UK welcomes its fourth Prime Minister in just 4 years, many are now looking to the future and if Rishi Sunak has what it takes to fix the many issues with Britain's troubled economy. Robert Carter reports from London.
During his first speech as British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak used the occasion to issue a call for unity. Sunak must find a way to quickly unite not just a bitterly divided Conservative Party, but also a deeply troubled nation. However, he also issued warnings of difficult times ahead.
I will place economic stability and confidence at the heart of this government's agenda. This will mean difficult decisions to come.
The Prime Minister has inherited a country in crisis. Energy prices are high, cost of living through the roof, and millions of Brits. Another worry for Sunak, Conservative Party popularity has plummeted in recent months, sitting approximately 30 points behind the opposition Labour Party. Sunak's supporters say he's economically experienced from his days as Chancellor and praised Sunak as Britain's youngest leader in 200 years and the first ever non-white leader. But his critics claim that's just not enough.
He definitely has the credentials. He definitely has the experience, been there in the, as Chancellor before. But again, we need to understand, you know, where does he sit right here, right now, with everyday voters? He has not been elected by the people, as well as he. Most people feel that he cannot resonate with the ones that are struggling. I'm not sure if it is real representation for anyone of a minority background, especially when he comes from a very, very elitist club, and he does not really represent many. He's probably top 1% of majority of brown people or Asians, whatever you want to call it, in the entire world. So it's very difficult to sort of resonate and feel sort of, close in that way.
Many challenges lie ahead for the new Prime Minister, in particular how he's going to overcome Britain's many economic crises. However, even if he does find a way to overcome Britain's economic woes, question marks still remain surrounding if he has what it takes to win the Conservatives the next general election. Robert Carter, London.
US President Joe Biden's public approval rating has been going down. That's according to a new poll by Reuters Ipsos ahead of the November midterm elections. The survey shows only 39% of Americans are satisfied with Biden's performance. The two-day national poll indicates one percentage point drop, from a week earlier. The latest poll shows about a third of Americans see economy as the principal problem facing the country. The respondents included both Democrats and Republicans. With the midterm elections coming, the new figure is raising alarms that Democrats may lose control of the House of Representatives as well as the Senate. The United States is facing high inflation, with many families struggling to cover their expenses. Biden's popularity hit a record low of 36% in May and June. Despite 2 decades of American military presence in Africa on the pretext of combating extremists and terrorists, the situation in the region is an absolute nightmare. Statistics show that U.S. arms and training have failed to contribute to their stated goal of reducing terrorism and militancy and increasing security in Africa. The figures demonstrate that they have rather prepared the ground for persistent and thriving terrorism across the continent.
After 20 years of American deployment in Africa, the Pentagon has admitted that the area is getting worse. The Pentagon says the security environment has deteriorated and that violence has expanded in intensity and geographic reach. A report from the Pentagon's Africa Center for Strategic Studies has shown that militant attacks increased by 300% in Africa over the past decade. Violent events linked to militant groups have doubled since 2019. More than 6,200 violent events were attributed to terrorist groups in 2022, a 21% increase from the previous year. Almost 15,000 deaths were linked to the increase in terrorist-related activity. The West Sahel region and Somalia were the militancy hotspots where nearly 95% of the attacks had been carried out since 2019. Extremist groups affiliated with Daesh and Al-Qaeda militants, such as Al-Shabaab, are mainly responsible for the attacks. In this regard, the Pentagon's African Command, or AFRICOM, whose area of responsibility covers all of Africa except Egypt, describes the duties of the force as promoting regional security, stability, and prosperity, while assisting to strengthen the security forces of allied nations. But it also admits AFRICOM will work to advance U.S. national interests on the continent. Both Somalia and the Sahel are actively hosting U.S. troops, and the U.S. now has some 30 military bases scattered across Africa. Former U.S. President Donald Trump had ordered the military to pull out all its troops from Africa. However, the incumbent ordered the U.S. military to maintain a permanent presence in Africa. Last year, U.S. President Joe Biden authorized the deployment of hundreds of American troops to reestablish a persistent U.S. military presence. The U.S. maintains its military presence in Africa under the pretext of fighting terrorism, but human rights groups say civilians have been caught in the crossfire and casualties from U.S. airstrikes are higher than have been reported. Also, Washington does not have a good track record, even when it comes to delivering on its stated claims of fighting terrorism. Somalia is a perfect example of systematic American military failures across the continent. After two decades of deployments, drone strikes, and commander raids to fight Al-Shabaab terrorists in the country, the militant group has proven resilient and is still able to carry out attacks in the country as well as neighboring states.
In recent years, there has been growing recognition that the U.S. is militarizing its foreign policy in Africa, especially following the establishment of the Africa Command in 2007. Years of U.S. military presence have only meant Washington getting involved in coups and the overthrow of several governments in Africa.
History has shown that the U.S. has brought instability and conflict to any region it has established a military foothold. Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, and Libya have all been subject to U.S. interventions and are experiencing chaos as a result. In recent years, there has been growing recognition of the militarization of U.S. foreign policy in Africa, especially following the establishment of the Africa Command in 2007. Despite its years-long military presence in Africa, the U.S. has not only failed to combat extremists and terrorists, but has also been involved in coups and the overthrow of several governments. Since 2008, U.S.-trained African military officers have attempted at least 9 coups in 5 Western African countries. According to a report, 8 such coups, which took place in Burkina Faso, Guinea, Mali, and Mauritania in different years, were successful. The failed coup was in Gambia in 2014. Confirmation is reported from the U.S. Africa Command that several African military leaders who staged coups in their countries participated in AFRICOM's flintlock exercises. Since 2015, 5 coups have been carried out by military leaders who had previously participated in Special Operations Command Africa flintlock exercises. The U.S. Department of Defense claims that these exercises, which were first conducted in Africa in 2005, are intended to strengthen the capacity of African countries to fight terrorism. But are they? Despite their claims, Americans have only been harbingers of more coups and more instability in Africa.
Well, those were the top stories for this hour.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
the supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick, and healed, and made well, and afflicted, and sat upon the throne, and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
British Prime Minister Liz Truss finally resigned, as experts had predicted her collapse days and even weeks before. Liz Truss's legacy for Britain was a tanking pound, soaring inflation, and a seemingly inevitable recession. World media websites have analyzed this issue and the economic challenges that face Britain. Stay tuned for the third part, please. Guardian wrote, Liz Truss ignored the stark warnings from economists sympathetic to her growth strategy that the mini-budget that ultimately led to her downfall risked triggering a financial markets meltdown. The Guardian has learned. Truss announced her resignation recently after just 44 days in Downing Street after a package of tax cuts and spending increases on September 23rd rattled the markets, prompted a run on pension funds, and sent the cost of mortgages spiraling. But days before the start of her premiership, she was told by The Economist, Gerard Lyons, and Julian Jessop that the markets were highly nervous and that she could face a crash if her policy changes were not handled with care. Lyons and Jessop, who were supportive of Truss' growth agenda, prepared a paper for a meeting at Scheveningen, the country residence of Foreign Secretary, as Truss was 2 days before she was announced as Boris Johnson's successor on September 5th. Also in attendance were Kwasi Kwarteng, who would be Truss's chancellor, Matteo Sinclair, Truss's economic policy advisor, and a third economist, Andrew Lilico. The paper supported the idea that the new government needed to hit the ground running, but repeatedly stressed the need to keep the financial markets one side. Predicting the chaos that was to follow Kwarteng's £45 billion of unfunded tax cuts announced in his September 23rd mini-budget, it said, the markets are nervous about the UK and about the policy options. If immediate economic policy announcements are handled badly, then a market crash is possible. It suggested the best policy option for the UK was to have higher interest rates from the Bank of England to curb inflation and tax cuts and spending increases from the Treasury to mitigate recession risks. However, financial markets are concerned that any fiscal easing may add to inflation, the paper added. Thus, to keep the markets one side, it is important that fiscal policy is explained clearly, that fiscal actions now are targeted and further ahead are focused on the supply side of the economy. There is a need to convince the markets that fiscal action is necessary, affordable, and non-inflationary. The hostile market reaction to the mini-budget led to most of the tax changes being reversed before Truss announced she was quitting. Kwarteng's successor, Jeremy Hunt, is expected to announce the spending cuts in a fiscal statement that is still scheduled to be held on September. Although that may change now, there is another conservative leadership race. Jessop said recently, "We were pretty clear the markets were very fragile and nervous. We said they needed to tread carefully and stage the process. We said there was a significant risk of a market crisis, and that's what happened. The overall strategy was right. The handling of it was terrible." Jessop said the opportunity to deliver on the growth strategy had now been lost. Supply-side reforms need a strong, committed prime minister. We have gone back to what we were trying to avoid, a doom loop of tax increases, spending cuts, and weak economic growth. A deep recession now starts to look more likely. Neither Lyons nor Jessop discussed the mini-budget with Truss after she became prime minister. Although Lyons again warned Kwarteng of the need to beware the markets in the days leading up to the fiscal event. "I sent a further note to the Chancellor after reading in the Sunday Times that the cuts in the stamp duty would feature as part of a mini-budget. The papers were making it out to be a much bigger event than the markets had expected it to be," Lyons said. He said the markets responded badly to the Kwarteng's initial package, but what tipped them over the edge was his announcement 2 days later that there would be more tax cuts to come. The markets were febrile, and that should have reinforced the need to be more careful. In their paper, Lyons and Jessop pointed to 5 policy challenges facing the new administration: addressing the energy crisis, inflation and the cost of living crisis, economic slowdown, departmental spending, particularly in areas of health, as higher inflation will have reduced the real spending power of planned government spending, and the need to avoid an imminent financial crisis and a sterling crash by outlining policies to address the above. They added, fiscal responsibility is paramount. Through a commitment to reducing the ratio of debt to GDP over time, thus ensuring solvency. Over time, public spending needs to be kept under control, with tax rates low. The fact that expectations about future economic and regulatory policy are low creates a great opportunity, but only if the new government hits the ground running. The only way to confront the present situation is to act decisively and not to hesitate, thus sending a clear message to the public and the financial markets.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Midstream.
Dr. Bathaina, an honor to be at your presence, and thank you for being with us to discuss pressing issues in Syria.
Thank you very much, Marwa, for coming to Damascus. It's a pleasure having you.
Our honor. Dr. Bathaina, I want us to begin with the ever-complicated game of geopolitics that Syria has a great and big role in it ever since the dawn of history, but specifically in the past two decades. The Western and regional regimes are acting as if Syria is just post-war, and they're trying to find some sort of new ways to maneuver politically with Syria, especially with the on-stage now war between Russia and Ukraine being center stage at the moment. And the biggest issue that Syria is still facing with the four most challenging and pressing issues is the occupation of the U.S. Forces in the eastern part of the Euphrates. You have the occupation of the Turks in the north, occupation of the Israelis in the Golan area, in the Golan Heights, and their aggression, continuous aggression, and also we have remnants of Daesh in certain areas, which are, by the way, in areas where the U.S. is still in Syria. But now, in what stage would you say Syria is right now, considering all these pressing challenges we just mentioned?
First, when the war started on Syria, there were only the Takfiri terrorists who are launching this war in all parts of Syria. only when the Syrian Arab Army with its alliances with Hezbollah, with Russia, with Iran, were able to defeat these terrorists in most areas in Syria, those who were leading the war by proxy, exactly the parties you named, the U.S., Israel, Turkey, jumped into the ground and came in order to continue the mission of the terrorists whose mission was to destroy Syria, to destroy its identity, to destroy its institutions. And therefore, and as you mentioned also, it is paradoxical that Daesh, that the U.S. claims to be fighting, is there in the neighborhood, in the areas, in the domain where the U.S. Steals our oil and our wheat and the resources of the Syrian people. Therefore, we are at another stage, really, of fighting against occupation. So I see these four occupations you mentioned as another side of the coin of the terrorist war that was launched in Syria. And their mission is to continue trying to divide Syria, trying to subjugate the Syrian people, trying to strangle the Syrian people by stealing its resources, by enforcing these extremely horrible unilateral measures that are unknown in humanity, that are against all human and international law. But as the Syrian people defeated the terrorists, they are going to defeat all these occupations, and Syria will be back united. Syria is 10,000 years old. This city, Damascus, is the eldest continuously inhabited capital in the world. The question why? Because its people will always come out from the rubble and rebuild it. And the aggressors are always defeated. And those who occupy parts of our land will be defeated.
Well, it does not take two to realize that when something positive tries to happen in the region, you always have the United States of America trying and attempting to break that positive thing. Like, for example, breaking the isolation of Syria, it wouldn't allow it, especially which would put Syria back on the regional scene heavily. Maybe by ensuring its military presence, pressing that they're there to help certain groups. But there's a certain rapprochement that's being spoken about in the media between Syria and Turkey, which is one of the biggest players in the global war against Syria. And when we talk about a rapprochement, we need to talk about trust. Where do you think Syria is on the ladder of trust with Turkey at the moment?
Well, I would like to draw your attention, Marwa, to the fact that we have 830 kilometers borders with Turkey. And if we didn't have these borders, those mercenaries from all over the world would not have been able to come to Syria. What I mean is that Turkey was the gateway for all the terrorists from all over the world to come to Syria. And Turkey was a major player in this terrorist war that was launched on Syria. And of course, it ended up by occupying parts of our land when the terrorists could not do the job that it wanted them to do. Therefore, what we hear in the media, for us, it doesn't mean much really, because there is no real initiative on the ground. There is no real talk on the ground. I mean, countries do not start talking through media. Those who occupy our lands have to withdraw first, have to show goodwill that they don't have really the intent to occupy our land for a long period, and that they are ready to withdraw, and that they start withdrawing. At least they honor the agreements they made. Erdogan signed with President Putin. He didn't honor the agreement he signed to withdraw and to let the M4 be free from Latakia to Aleppo. He didn't honor any of the agreements he did. And therefore, they are bubbling in the media. And as you notice, Syria did not say anything because it doesn't mean much to us. It's not serious unless we see serious steps towards this. Trust you build with somebody who is trustworthy, whose history shows that he is trustworthy, but he has to prove on the ground with action, as the Americans say, actions speak louder than words. So all what we hear is words. We need to see actions.
Well, this brings us to discuss the relationship of Syria with its allies this time, and that stood in support of Syria's territorial integrity and Syria's sovereignty against all that had happened. And one of the main allies of Syria is the Russian Federation. It helped fight terrorism and Western neocolonialism, but it's always found in pan-Arab media after every aggression that Syria is faced from the Israeli entity. We see that the media focuses on Russia, our pan-Arab media focuses on Russia negatively. And they say this because they say that because of Russia removing the S-300, this is a permissive move for the Israelis to attack Damascus. Therefore, they hold similar responsibility. And I know that you might disagree with this, but how would you explain the sideline behavior of Syria's main ally at a time when Israel does not miss a chance to try and break Syria militarily and economically?
Well, let me first comment in your sentence, pan-Arab media. Unfortunately, most of this pan-Arab media does not represent Arab ambitions and Arab rights and does not even reflect the truth about the Arabs. The second part of it is that Russia, as an ally, took the first double veto with China against Western intended aggression towards Syria on 4th of October 2011. Since that time, Russia has taken 17 vetoes against intended Western aggression towards Syria, and China joined Russia in 10 of these vetoes. So this is an ally that you can't trust. Mm-hmm. And then in 2015, as you know, Russia came to the ground with advisors, with Air Force help to the Syrian army to help the Syrian army in fighting terrorism. But all this, if you want, media war against Russia in Syria is to strengthen the enemy, really, and to try and make the people feel that Russia is not trustworthy, that we should not trust Russia. Russia today is fighting a war on behalf of humanity, really, because the war in the Ukraine is, in its truth, is a war between a Western hegemony and between the world that aspires to have its own independent decision and its own integrity. And therefore, Russia, of course, has its own geopolitical needs. And as allies, we understand each other and we agree with each other on any steps. But they did not mention that Russia and the Russian air forces and the Syrian air forces are leading attacks against terrorists in the northeast and the northwest of Syria. They didn't mention the effort Russia is making in order to prevent U.S. allies from partitioning Syria. They don't mention the positive side. We, as Syria, have a trustworthy ally in Russia. Every step, every move is agreed by both, both of us, and there's no problem at all. And just imagine that Syria without allies in the region, or Russia without allies. We need to really solidify our alliance. And I was talking to you off air, that the strength of the West is that they get their alliances together, even to do wars and to do wrong things. So we should do our alliances together and strengthen them to do good things, to keep our identity, to keep our independence, to keep our integrity. All the media that tries to plant doubts, either against Russia or against Iran. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are many in the Arab media now, they say the problem is not Israel, it's Iran.
Definitely, and this is where I want to end off with the allies of Syria here, because it's no secret that Iran and Hezbollah played a great role alongside the Syrian Arab Army in preventing the Takfiri terrorism from Syria and eliminating also from Iraq and Lebanon. But they are also being blamed in the Western mainstream media and Israeli media as well, as they being the reason that Israel is bringing out its weapons and bombing Syria. Have these allies become some sort of a burden for Syria because they are here to help, because that's why Israel is bombing?
No, not at all. The only burden in the region is the Zionist enemy. That is the only burden in the region. As if Israel wasn't an aggressor before this war, as if Israel wasn't an aggressor before we strengthen our relation with Iran and before Hezbollah and Iran come to help Syria. Of course they will criticize, because this is against their agenda. The more we get together, the more angry they will feel. Now, I think the reason why the Zionist enemy and Western allies as well are very careful or very anxious about what's happening in the region is the plan to do a railway between Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. This, for them, is a great threat. They say because it carries arms to Hezbollah. It's not because of that. Because it's going to make the region flourishing region, because it's going to do great service to the people of the region. We have to agree that the ultimate aim of all these wars against us is to prevent us from developing, from prospering, from becoming a major player in the region. That is their aim. And therefore, really, we have to learn that whatever they say, you know, we have to interpret it, analyze it, edit it, and refuse most of it.
Well, that concludes our first segment, but brings us with a great push to our second segment of the show to talk about most pressuring issues happening right here inside Syria, where the Syrian civilians are feeling the most of it, which is the economic hardships, because the calamity to the Syrian economy for over 10 years of Takfiri terrorism, Western illegal, unilateral, punitive measures, they cannot be underestimated and they can be felt by the public. I mean, the heavy combat in Syria is probably over, the heavy bombardment campaigns. But the situation, it's becoming worse by the day economically, especially with the U.S. CSERS Act of 2019, the civilian, so-called Syrian Civilian Protection Act of 2019, and the U.S. looting more than $100 billion of Syrian oil and Syrian resources, where they are occupying land inside of Syria. And there might be some victories still going on the battlefield, and everyone recognizes them, but it's not really tangible to the citizens, but rather the losses are. In your views, how can Syria really survive this painful economic hardship?
Well, before answering this question, let me say something. Yeah. Yesterday, I was attending a lecture by Talal Abu Ghadale at Damascus University, and he said he was on the board of World Trade, International World Trade, and an important paragraph in that is that no country in the world has the right to impose sanction on any other country unilaterally without the approval either of the UN or the World Trade, or without the approval of a body, an international body. And therefore, what the U.S. called Syrian Protection Act, it is actually a criminal act. It's not a protection act. It's a criminal act against the Syrian people. And I see in it a continuation of the terrorist war against Syria, because they failed to make Syria succumb, as you said in your introduction. So they turned now first to occupying the land directly, to robbing our resources. And I don't know how any country can claim to be leading in the world and yet under daylight steals the resources of another people. I mean, this is moral bankruptcy for any country. And so they turn to economic sanctions, to what is called Caesar's Act, in order to strangle the Syrian people. Of course, this is accompanied with the media you mentioned, whether pan-Arab media or Israeli media or Western media, against Russia, against Iran, against Syria, against the steadfastness, in order to make the Syrian people give up and say, okay, we can't do anything. Mm-hmm. But if they read history, they know that this is not the Syrian people who are going to do that. The Syrian people are going to soldier on with finding new ways of survival. Yesterday, our President Bashar al-Assad reopened the Center for Excellence in Homs. This was first opened in 2009. 2011, the terrorists destroyed it. That was one of the first targets. That proves that they don't want us to be excellent, to be achievers. They want us to be followers of what they want us to do. Mm-hmm. Syria was able first to make this center carry on in its teaching, in Latakia, in Damascus, everywhere, and now to rebuild this center. And yesterday, students went back to the center. Farmers went back to their lands. They are sowing, they are reaping, they are producing. This huge problem is an opportunity for Syria to be totally self-reliant in everything it wants. And the Syrian people are so creative and so determined and so rooted that no one will be able to uproot them.
Mm-hmm. Does that simply mean that with Syria mending its ties with certain Arab states that were against Syria at one point but now seem to have taken a U-turn, does that new relationship mean they might be willing to fund improvements in economics and development, social development, economic development inside Syria?
Well, that is a political decision, and I don't know whether it's a totally political decision or whether it has to do with those parties who convinced them at the beginning to finance the war. You saw foreign ministers on TV saying that they put $37 billion of dollars to finance the war on Syria. So if they now don't, the world doesn't help Syria, it is, for me, understandable because they didn't want Syria to survive anyway.
But they did open new doors of communication with Syria, for example, like the UAE.
There are new doors, but they haven't yet reached the point of becoming essential for rebuilding in Syria. Because, as I said, you know, we don't know who can and who cannot do to political circumstances and to political decision. Syria is open, and Syria doesn't have a resentment. You know, even internally, President Bashar al-Assad started a reconciliation process many years ago, and it has got its fruition, really, in the country. And therefore, we look to the future. We are not people who work on resentment and who look into the past. What I mean is that, of course, after wars, countries will go back, will start relations, but on certain basis, on the basis of integrity, of dignity, and with full respect to those who sacrifice their lives in order to protect the independent decision of the country. Mm-hmm. That's most important.
And when you say that Syrians do not hold a grudge and do not resent, it's basically because of the bringing up. And bringing up means the role of women in the Syrian society. I mean, the global war in Syria had devastating impact on women. It also had shifted their roles in the workforce inside of Syria. But consequently, women are becoming increasingly influential in the public space in Syria and shaping Syria's future. I want to read an excerpt from your book, which I would love for you to sign for me when we finish our interview. But you say, I believe it is time Arab women learned...
From this book.
Yes, I will say exactly the title of the book, which is Both Right and Left-Handed,
yeah,
by Dr. Buthaina Shaban. It's about stories of Arab women,
yeah,
in our region. And in this book, you practically say that, I believe it is time Arab women learned not to fight men's battles while losing out themselves. I think our priority as women should be to help spread a feminist consciousness in every domain and across all categories, social categories, in order to be prepared for these struggles to come. You wrote this in the Both Right and Left-Handed in 1988.
Yeah.
Were Syrian women ready for the tsunami wave that struck in 2011, as it still has shock waves and ripples affecting the ability to create maybe even new unthinkable challenges for these women?
I don't think anybody was ready for this tsunami. I think the whole so-called Arab Spring, which is an Arab disaster, took everybody by surprise. But we quickly adapted to the situation and started to deal with it. And I really believe at times of crisis, as at other times, peaceful times, women have an extremely fundamental role to play. And in this war, as you said, women are the ones who actually bring up their children, who are the ones who plant in their heads the importance of the country, the sacrifice for the country. I mean, if you see the Syrian women whose sons would go to fight terrorists and that they would receive their bodies, first son and second son, and they would say, this is, you know, an honor for us because it is for the sake of the country. I mean, it takes really great bravery for a mother and great also belief, great faith in the country to be able to say that. Now, I wrote this book in the aftermath of the liberation also of Algeria. I made many interviews with Algerian women. And Algerian women said that we were fighting the political war, but without paying attention to our rights. And when the war was over, we did not get our rights. And what I meant is that during the war, when women are sacrificing and women are playing an important role in fighting this war, they should also think of their rights. The whole, not only women, men also should think of radicalizing the society, not just winning the war on the ground in the battlefield, but winning the social war, winning the economic war, winning the human war, winning the educational war. Therefore, that's what I mean, and I believe in that, really. I mean, I was a feminist, I'm still a feminist, but now I believe that I'm capable to fight not only for women, not only for Arab women and men, but for human being in general, everywhere. And therefore, there are basic rules that should apply that would make everybody happier. But I don't believe in Western feminism.
Thank you very much, Dr. Shaban, for your time and for your contribution to our show.
Thank you very much, Marwa, and all the power to you.
Thank you.
I think the world needs you, not only Arab women. The world needs your voice.
I'm humbled by your words. Thank you very much.
The limelight.
The recent attacks by Zionist settlers against Palestinians are an attempt to inflame the situation in the occupied territories to the benefit of party campaigns ahead of the Zionist regime's next month's election. According to reports, these attacks have been perpetrated by a large number of settlers, including women and children. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Middle East Eye, there have been more than 100 attacks by Israeli settlers against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank over the last 10 days, according to local media. The Israeli regime newspaper Haaretz recently said that most of the attacks it had documented had taken place in the northern West Bank, especially in the town of Hawara in Nablus Governorate. Last week, dozens of settlers attacked Palestinian property and vehicles in the Hawara area. Witnesses told Middle East Eye that masked settlers threw rocks at Palestinian vehicles near the town, as well as setting vehicles and olive trees on fire. Abdullah Odeh, who owns a local amusement park in Hawara, said residents had almost been successful in repelling the settlers when a group of Israeli troops arrived. The settlers were retreating, but when they saw the soldiers, they came back in force and started to get closer, breaking everything in their path, Odeh said, adding, "The soldiers did not push them back. Instead, they started to attack us and shoot towards us." Footage from Odeh's security cameras reviewed by Middle East Eye corroborates his history. He says, "While the soldiers were pushing us back and attacking us, the settlers started to set fire to one of our vans that was parked higher up on the hill, while another group of them came and started to set fire to one of our lorries. Armed with stones, sticks, and guns, another group of settlers began throwing rocks at passing cars and smashing up shops along the town's main road. Recently, two activists were injured by Zionist settlers armed with stones and clubs while helping Palestinians harvest olives in the village."